This week it's women's right to vote and a writer, but that's surely not all she wrote. Adoption and engineers who answer the call. Hey, welcome to Spectrum West, y'all. I like doing that southern thing. This is where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin shines and shouts. I'm Al Ross. How are you? This week, Tom Vanderbilt. And no, I did not ask him if it's the Vanderbilts. I'm guessing not because he works hard for each freelancing writing paycheck, but he's popular and probably doing okay. We'll talk about his books and his Time magazine article about singing. Jim Oliver talks with an engineer, Michael Paddock, who is now an author as well. He wrote about how he and others in the same profession volunteer to build bridges, the societal kind and the ones that cross rivers. Catherine Thomas welcomes Julie Booth, Recreation Program Supervisor for the City of Eau Claire. You can adopt parks and trails, and she'll tell you how. And this is where we get our feet wet. It should be 244 years old, but women's right to vote is a mere 100 this year. Better late than never, I guess. They're celebrating the 19th Amendment in Menominee, and two guests, Melissa Neeland of the Rosbach Museum and Margie Hageman of the League of Women Voters, joined me on the phone earlier in the week. It's a bit weird talking about women's right to vote. For most of us, it feels like it's always been around, but it hasn't. It took a lot of work, about 72 years to be exact, to achieve what happened 100 years ago. As members of the gender category that had to do all the fighting, what and how do you guys think about your sisters whose voices were raised and petticoats ruffled enough to finally get this done? Let's start with Margie.
It took three generations, so people did not even live to see their vote count. I appreciate the fact that they gave part of their family life, and some of them did not even marry, like Susan B. Anthony did not even marry, but she was able then to go out and publicize the right to vote. She was even in Menominee speaking on the amendments to get the right to vote. Other people had families, and their husbands ended up taking over childcare, where they were able to hire it so that they were able to go out and try to get this right to vote. They felt it was very important. They have a say in what happens to their lives.
Melissa, these ladies who went before you and did all the work, inspiring for you?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's actually pretty amazing that you had mentioned petticoats getting ruffled. There's actually a great anti-suffrage pamphlet telling men and women about why the suffrage movement is not a positive thing. And one of the things they threaten is, would you want to be subject to petticoat rule?
Ooh.
Which is a really great phrase, I think. But yeah, I definitely echo what Margie said. And it's interesting because there were men who also were part of the suffrage movement. There was a lot of interesting crossover, especially at the beginning, between the anti-slavery movement and the women's rights movement as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some really interesting crossovers, and some people, especially Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, those are women who started the Seneca Falls Convention, mm-hmm. and they actually met at a World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. So a lot of these women were very complex. They had differing views. So it's a really complex, interesting story. And as Margie said, having someone like Susan B. Anthony even come and speak in Dunn County in 1875 is really amazing. And some of these women, I really admire the different ways. They all found different ways to make their voices heard. And some were through letter writing and personal interactions between people. And others like Alice Paul were the first people to picket in front of the White House and create really a huge splash and put themselves in bodily danger a lot of times when they were fighting for these things. Also, women like Ida B. Wells and Sojourner Truth, there are a lot of women of color who aren't necessarily as represented sometimes in the story of women's suffrage, but who were as adamant and as just amazing in their fight for their rights.
Yeah, impressive stuff. True pioneers. I was going to talk about the antique vintage aspect of this, but the truth is, and it's kind of sad to say, human rights struggles continue to this day. Minorities, immigrants, and yes, women are still working for levels of equality. So although the exhibit we're going to talk about is centennial in nature, it appears that people will be talking about 2020 movements 100 years from now. Margie, in this day and age, the League of Women Voters actually represents all voters in the way it encourages us to exercise our most important right. But there is a movement that involves women in politics. More are entering, more are getting elected. So the League would be perceived as vital as ever. Tell us about some of what you do.
It started 100 years ago when women got the right to vote. That's when it started, because it needed to educate women about the issues and how to vote. Locally, we had a League of Women Voters here in the 70s and 80s, one in Eau Claire and one in Menominee. But they kind of died out. And about 4 years ago, there was a feeling that we needed to develop something in the area again that was nonpartisan. So we ended up forming the Greater Chippewa Valley. And we look at issues and voter service issues. We register voters, we go to the schools and the farmers markets, and also have a program called Vote 411, where we have candidates that share their positions on issues. So we are nonpartisan, and we do try to take stands on issues, though, once we have studied them, and we kind of have a direction of what we'd like to do, and then make that known. That's kind of what we're about, voter service and education. And we do have men that are involved, too. So we do encourage women to run, but we're not partisan, so we're not supporting particular candidates.
So you are chair of the Celebration Committee as well. How long has the Celebration Committee been getting together to do this?
Well, initially, we were planning to have a play at the Mabel Tainer Theater, and then we were going to have parades. We were going to be involved in the Pure Water Parade and other kinds of celebrations and parties. Well, that all fell apart. So we're having the exhibit, We Stand on Your Shoulders, at the museum. And then we are doing some virtual kinds of things. We have identified public television and a number of resources for the Historical Society, sending it out to teachers. The other thing is the Eau Claire Women in Theater have done three vignettes that are marvelous about the suffrage movement. Those are online, too. So all these things that are online that families can use, teachers could use, and the real celebration is August 26th, the 100th anniversary date. And we're going to have some kind of celebration in downtown Menominee. We're going to social distance and have somewhat of a celebration.
Oh, good. You're making the most of it. Good for you. So, Melissa, by way of an introduction, what kinds of permanent exhibits are in the museum? And then we'll get on to what you're bringing in.
Sure. So we have quite a large museum, many exhibits. We have a interactive Caddy Woodlawn exhibit. We just put in a new exhibit about prohibition in Dunn County that includes an entirely recreated speakeasy or homebrew joint, and it has all the original furniture and artifacts. We have a display of really beautiful mid-century Buicks in our transportation room. Our newest addition is Fulton's Workshop, which is an entire new part of the museum. The history of machinist tools, manufacturing, inventing, and it even has an interactive makerspace. Kids love it, and then the most fun is when you see parents who are also having a hard time walking away from the magnet wall because they're having fun, too.
We're on the phone with Melissa Nealon. She's executive director of the Rasbach Museum, and Margie Hageman, past president, the League of Women Voters Greater Chippewa Valley. We're talking about the celebration of women's right to vote, suffrage, 19th Amendment. We Stand on Their Shoulders is an exhibit from the Wisconsin Historical Society coming to the museum in Menominee August 4th through 15th. In addition to that traveling exhibit, I understand, Melissa, you also have artifacts relative to women's suffrage.
Yes, indeed we do. They are hard to come by, so we're really fortunate. We actually have a number of pins that people really do associate, I think, with the suffrage movement, those small pins that say votes for women. in the spirit of the exhibit itself, which kind of uses the suffrage movement as a jumping off point to talk even more about women in politics into Wisconsin's more current history, we feature a few other artifacts that show women in politics locally and also statewide.
Was Ms. Anthony's visit to Dunn County documented?
Yes, indeed it was. As part of the exhibit, we went through quite a few newspaper articles in the Dunn County News from the 1860s through 1921 to pull some of the most relevant articles to also have in the exhibit. I do have the actual newspaper article, everyone's impressions of her speaking, when Susan B. Anthony came in 1875 in November in Dunn County for people to read about.
Audience members out there need to realize it's only here for a week and a half.
That's very true. It's August 4th through the 15th, and what we're doing to ensure safety for both the public and our staff, we're doing visits by appointment. We have about 45-minute time slots. If you can get a group together, not a large group. We don't want to have 20 or 30 people in the exhibit at one time, so we can ensure social distancing. You can call the museum. We're opening a little earlier, especially for the exhibit. Slots open from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. in 45-minute slots. You can come on in, and hopefully we can get as many people in as possible, as safely as possible.
And, of course, everyone is urged to take it in for moms and daughters, grandmothers and granddaughters, the younger generation. My generation's even tough to relate with this, the struggle and the fact that it wasn't always here.
What a wonderful thing for a generation of women to not be able to comprehend that they wouldn't have the right to vote.
Yes.
Bring the sons, too.
I agree, Margie. Yeah, it's important to have everyone come. The other nice thing is, of course, you come down to the museum, and then, of course, you're right in Wakanda Park. Enjoy the outdoors as well.
Exactly. So. Thanks to the League of Women Voters, Girl Scouts of Northwest Great Lakes, American Association of University Women, and the Rosbach Museum. I wish we had more time to talk. We don't, however. Where should people go to get all the details they need?
The Dunn County Historical Society website, which is dunnhistory.org. Mm-hmm. We'll also have information on our Facebook page.
And what's online, Margie?
Go to the League of Women Voters or LWV-TV, which is League of Women Voters Greater Chippewa Valley, or go to the Facebook page.
Melissa Neeland and Margie Hageman, thank you so much for all the work you've done to put this together. This is vital stuff. Looking back makes us more able to look ahead. So way to go. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was fun. Finding and sharing your voice, even during a pandemic. Jim Oliver's guest bridges barriers, and Catherine Thomas steps in next, here on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, offering the fully redesigned RAV4 with all-wheel drive and new safety features, located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. And while we're talking about birthdays, happy 30th birthday to the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was an amazing step back then, and many are still fighting for a completely level playing field. I trust we'll all continue to follow it, cheer from the bleachers, and do what we can when we can. I think adoption is a wonderful concept, especially when you can add a park or a trail to the family. Here's Catherine Thomas and her special guest, Julie Booth.
It's Parks and Recreation Month, so happy Parks and Recreation Month.
Thank you. It's fun.
Yeah, I hear the city of Eau Claire is celebrating with its new Adopt a Park or Trail initiative, but before we talk about that, why do we care about parks and trails in the city of Eau Claire?
Well, Eau Claire has over 52 parks, 1,000-plus acres of land within our system of parks and trails. And the initiative for Adopt a Park is to attract people to create more pride in their land, become stewards of their land, build some community involvement within neighborhoods or businesses and families. And we just want to try to create the awareness as well as provide beautification opportunities for our partnering families and businesses.
Yeah, I've seen a number of the parks around town, some really small, some much bigger. The diversity is pretty amazing. So I would bet you'd welcome groups of people or individuals. There's a park
right.
size for just about anybody.
Yeah. And not only the size, the variety of interests. You know, we have fishing areas and boat landings. We have skateboard parks. We have observation areas. We have activity areas such as the ball fields and tennis courts, pickleball courts. We have a park up at Mount Zion that has the disc golf. So there's just a wide variety that could attract people for their interests.
Right. And I think people are probably spending more time outside these days because it's summer, but also because being outside is a safe place to be during a pandemic. Are you noticing even more use of the trails and parks?
Absolutely. And it's so fun to see, especially the trails and the waterways. Many local businesses can hardly even stock some recreational equipment with fishing and kayaking, canoeing accessories, and bikes. Our citizens are wanting to get out and recreate either as family or, you know, with friends or independently. And with that, that does bring heavier use. And unfortunately, sometimes it also does bring up some environmental concerns for our parks, which many of our volunteers assist us with.
Yes, and I wondered, besides having volunteers, I thought the city was the caretaker of parks and trails.
They are. We have in most of our parks, which is all governed by our city. We have assigned staff. Some of them, particularly one such as perhaps Owen Park, only has one lead staff member. This summer, with the pandemic concerns, we were unable to bring in any of our seasonals for our street department and our parks. Therefore, much of the small maintenance opportunities were sometimes we hit and miss when you only have one staff member assigned to a particular park. And that can be a very daunting list of tasks to take care of. So we do rely on volunteers and interest groups to help us in various areas.
I was a little worried asking for volunteers was a sign that the city didn't have any money in the budget for parks, and we should be concerned.
No. You know, we're always seeking ways to involve community, whether that be volunteering for our youth sport programs. The bigger our systems get, and the more usage they get, that comes with more need for stewardship projects. With the upkeep of not only the amenities within parks, the landscape themselves always can use some extra assistance. We all know if you're gardeners or have large lawns or woods areas to upkeep, that spring and fall are very key components to your quality upkeep.
Yeah, I was thinking also of another event the city usually organizes, which is the amazing Eau Claire cleanup every spring. And that didn't happen this year. So I thought, well, maybe this Adopt-a-Park program could be a way for those people who usually volunteer for that and new people as well to get that similar experience in making the city better through the Adopt-a-Parks and Trail program.
Absolutely. The amazing Eau Claire cleanup is one of our largest volunteer activities that we host, providing upwards to near 500 people to assist with 40 to 50 projects, specific targeted areas around our city on one day. And due to the pandemic, we were unable to host that event. And therefore, the crew that we did have available at the beginning of the season was trying to focus on the most heavily used areas our community uses. So the Adopt-a-Park program, we've already had a few committed agencies who are encouraging their employees to participate and adopt certain areas as a work group.
Julie Booth is here to tell us about the City of Eau Claire's new Adopt-a-Park or Trail program. Julie is the Recreation Program Supervisor for the City of Eau Claire. Julie, why don't we get to what the program is? How does the Adopt-a-Park or Trail program work? I mean, I take it that I don't just show up at my favorite park and get to work. Or do I?
Well, you can always do that. That's fabulous. I encourage citizens to be great stewards of our park system. So if you see trash or items that need to have some attention in our parks, people can feel free to assist us or absolutely report it to our parks division so that we can take care of that. But the actual adoption of parks is a new initiative designed in cooperation with myself as the city's volunteer coordinator, and the Leadership Eau Claire group really wanted to establish this initiative. It's a very simple registration process. It's not a lot of work at all. It's available to anyone in the city, large or small group, as we mentioned earlier.
And what are the responsibilities? If I sign up, what should I expect?
A little bit of overview of the program. We can share our website to the public at the end of this or my email. It's a simple contact to me. Some groups have a specific area of interest. Other groups just say, we want to help. Do you have projects or an area that we should be assigned to? So that can go either way. The groups that adopt a park are asked to commit 2 years of service so they can create some pride in their area of upkeep. They can create some quality relationships amongst their group, perhaps even the crew that's working during the week there. I monitor adopted areas usually once a month, specifically April through October during our greatest growing season. That includes good grass and weeds. And typically the group will have one leader that is our kind of mediator, go-between myself, the park crew, and their group. Some of the activities, as simple as walking the trail and picking up trash or litter, walking along riverbanks. It could be raking and pulling leaves in specific flower beds of choice. We have a lot of playgrounds, and each year we need to fluff up and reestablish the mulch because we want to keep it safe for the neighborhood kids. The season of COVID could even be washing equipment or shelter amenities to help keep things safe. A big part of it also, Catherine, is helping us be the eyes out there. Several of the groups have already been in close contact with me about things that they've noticed. Then they can have some expediency in going down and fixing whatever it is that's the concern. That's one of my biggest pleasures, the opening of communications with the public.
It sounds like a great partnership. Take ownership for public spaces that we all use and appreciate.
Right.
Is the Recreation Department hoping to have any other events for the rest of the year? It's kind of hard to plan things right now, but I wondered if you had anything in mind going forward.
Sure. Beyond the Adopted Park, we are hoping to plan some fall programming that will abide by our CDC and local health department guidelines. Most of our programs are in partnership with the school district, with the schools being closed. That influenced our decision of not being able to, you know, house a lot of the programs. We have a lot of beautiful shelters and playground areas within neighborhoods that we're hoping to provide some events this fall.
That's Julie Booth, the Recreation Program Supervisor for the City of Eau Claire. She's also the Volunteer Coordinator. You can find more information about the Adopt a Park a Trail program and other recreational opportunities on the City of Eau Claire website, or you can call the Recreation Department. Julie Booth, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And if you're raring to sign up because it's not only something to do, but a worthwhile something to do, crank out an email to this address, recvolunteers@eauclairewi.gov. And when you do it, bring the entire family. It's going to be fun. He's an award-winning New York author who just happened to spend younger years in Wisconsin, and his soon-to-be-released book is about trying new things. His new thing is singing, and he loves it. Tom Vanderbilt, a bit later in the program. For now, borders have been in the news a bunch over the past few years, mostly about building walls on them as barriers to keep people from crossing them. But Jim Oliver read a book about barriers and the absence of borders. Here's his report.
Michael Paddock grew up in northern Minnesota and attended Michigan Technical University, receiving bachelor's degrees in civil engineering and surveying. He's a licensed professional engineer and surveyor whose professional career was spent managing teams of over 100 engineers, designing infrastructure projects exceeding $1 billion. And for the past 20 years, he has maintained a pro bono engineering career that has delivered over 100 projects with Engineers Without Borders USA, Rotary International, and other nonprofits on five continents. Most recently, he has published the book, Bridging Barriers, How a Community Changed Its Future with Help from Engineers Without Borders USA Volunteers. Before we get to the book, tell us about Engineers Without Borders and how did you get involved?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Engineers Without Borders is a group formed back in 2002. It really focuses on helping communities build sustainable solutions around the globe. And it also works with engineers and other leaders to solve the world's most pressing challenges. And since 2002, it's really grown. We have chapters at all of the engineering universities here in Wisconsin, I think a total of about 250 chapters around the U.S., University of Wisconsin, Madison, Milwaukee, Platteville, Marquette University, Milwaukee School of Engineering, and Stout. It's really taken off. A lot of projects in corners of the world, particularly focusing on Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Uganda, because those three locations have country offices.
Now, there is a man named Mike Shawcross, who you talk about in the book. Will you talk about him a little bit?
Mike Shawcross, or Don Mike, as the locals refer to him, is kind of a character beyond characters. A British citizen, early in his life, he decided he was going to hitchhike from London all the way to China with 20 pounds in his pocket. After he got done with that adventure, he went to Canada to explore caves and map caving. And that love of caves really took him to Guatemala. Once he got there, he fell in love with the people and their culture and stayed there for 40 years doing development work as a volunteer to help the people there. And I was just so fortunate. He became my mentor and taught me so much. And these are the lessons that I do my best to share with the audience that reads the book, Bridging Barriers.
Well, most of us in North America know very little about what happens in Guatemala, unless it's some refugees walking through Mexico to get to the U.S. border or some kind of an uprising. You did your work in, I can't pronounce this, La Garrucha. La Garrucha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the story really starts, Jim, with a midwife. Her name is Gavina. Gavina was incredibly frustrated. You know, midwives, they go through training, knew how to do their job. They just had two big barriers. One was a bridge was not there, so they couldn't cross this nasty river called the Rio Motagua, which was nicknamed the Assassin because of so many people who had died trying to cross it. And the second barrier was a potable water system. They had identified those two barriers and had approached Don Mike to see if he could maybe provide some assistance. And subsequently, Don Mike had engaged myself and the chapter of Engineers Without Borders at Marquette University to see if we could solve those two challenges.
How did the government react to people coming from someplace else to work on this project?
The government was very supportive, and I think this is one of the keys of the development program that Don Mike taught me. You know, many organizations, I think, prefer to work outside the government because it might be a little bit easier. But because of the storied history in Guatemala with guerrilla warfare and other concerns, Don Mike really felt it was critical that this linkage between the people and their government be restored. And so in this particular project, we had two governments that were involved, almost like states. They're called departments. So it'd be almost like Minnesota and Wisconsin getting together to build a bridge across the river, as well as local government needed to be involved as well. And so you can imagine there was lots of discussions and agreements and all kinds of issues that came up with that. But I think one of the lasting benefits of the program, people realized that they could engage with their government, solve their own problems with the assistance of the government, and the government came to recognize the citizens that it represents as well and really embrace the idea of working together. So sometimes it's more than just the bridge or the water project. It's making these connections.
He is Michael Paddock, author of Bridging Barriers, How a Community Changed Its Future with Help from Engineers Without Borders. We should be talking about your book a little bit. How did you come about the idea of writing a book in the first place, and how long did it take you?
Well, you know, Jim, engineers probably are not known for writing books. It was pretty intimidating. But when Don Mike had passed away about 5 years ago, I always knew that it really wasn't an option for me. It really was an obligation to pay forward his lessons learned. so that others would be able to share in his wisdom.
So how long did it take you?
When we had gone to the community 10 years after the projects were completed and done what we call an impact analysis to see how the community had fared and if the projects were still functioning, that was about 18 months ago. The community had just really embraced their development and had taken off and done so many things, completely eliminated the infant and maternal mortality, as well as improved attendance at the school. Before the project, there was 300 absences per month at the school, and now there were only two. And it was just so impressive to me on how the community had responded. That's when I said, well, I need to start putting pen to paper on this particular project. So about 18 months was the process.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about the lay of the land, so to speak, that you had to deal with there. Talk a little bit about the water quality as you first encountered it, and is it staying together pretty well?
Yeah. I think one of the important lessons that I learned was we needed to work in concert with the land instead of trying to overcome maybe the challenges that are there. And this is a challenging location. It's very mountainous. There's steep slopes. And it happens to be the location where two continental plates come together, the South American plate, the Caribbean as it's called, and the North American plate that come together right in this river valley. Because of that, two things. One, it's a place that there's a lot of earthquakes, and of course us bridge engineers realize that that's an additional challenge. But the other part, because those plates are struggling against each other, groundwater is at a very deep depth. It's difficult to drill wells in this location, and because of that, many of the people get their water from natural springs, or unfortunately, in this particular case, the community was forced to fetch water from the stream, sufficient in quantity, but terribly contaminated, and hence that was many of the infections and illnesses that were caused. But the project was able to identify a spring that was about 5 kilometers away, pipe that water to the community using gravity to push the water, and then distribute that water out throughout the community. And thankfully, after 10 years, the water continues to flow there. Water tests show that it was of still great quality, and the people were really taking pride in maintaining that particular water system. So again, it really shows, I think, the commitment of the community to maintain and develop their own needs and address those needs on their own.
So where is the book available? I got my hands on one, thanks to your father, I think. But, you know, the thing about the book is it's a bit technical in nature, but even for those of us who aren't so technical, we found it interesting just in general how things can work with a bunch of engineers getting together.
Yeah, the book is available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, so you can get it from those websites. And you could also get it from the book's website, which is bridgingbarriers.com.
Well, one thing I forgot to ask, more of a personal nature, I guess. How do you work in the time to, I'm assuming you're still a practicing engineer, and yet you go off and do these volunteer projects. How do you work that out?
Yeah, you know, Jim, it really became a commitment when I kind of unexpectedly recovered from cancer. I guess it'd be 23 years ago now. And When it became clear that I was still going to be on this planet for a while, my wife, Kathy, and I made the commitment we would kind of restructure our lives so that I would be able to spend as much time as possible doing this kind of engineer work. It was a struggle for a while to work on my engineering career as a consulting engineer, building such projects as maybe Highway 29. But fortunately, we've kind of got ourselves in a good position financially so that 5 years ago, we could do this work full-time as a volunteer. Right now, I've taken a sabbatical from Engineers Without Borders to take on an assignment with the United Nations Development Program to help them with the COVID-19 response.
Uh-huh. That's definitely a challenge ahead of you then. We've been talking to Michael Paddock, author of Bridging Barriers, How a Community Changed Its Future with Help from Engineers Without Borders, USA Volunteers. Well, it's a great book. Thanks so much for taking a little time to talk to us.
Thank you so much, Jim. And as the midwives would remind us, make sure we wash our hands and wear our masks.
Awfully good advice. Thank you, Mr. Oliver and Mr. Paddock. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, where support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, offering the mobile app that provides access 24/7 to view balances, pay bills, and more. Available on iPhone, iPad, and Android. More is at charterbank.bank. I'd like to send out hearty congratulations to John Potter, who has led the team at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson for the past 35 years. Impressive levels of community and regional prominence in the arts. It's been a distinct pleasure being able to talk with John over my years at this microphone. And we all wish him well in a retirement that I wager won't so much resemble a retirement as it will a reboot. Thanks, John. Time magazine is just one of many notable periodicals in which the words on Tom Vanderbilt often appear. If he's not writing on some topic for a magazine, he's blogging or sitting at the computer working on his next book, some of which are award-winning and all of which are diverse in theme and range. He wrote an article for Time magazine's late July edition about not being able to sing in physical proximity to other members of the New York City Choir Project, where showing up is all they ask. No auditions. They don't show up now, though. We reached Tom Vanderbilt by phone at home in the aforementioned New York City. If one is to believe Wikipedia, you were born in Illinois and raised in Wisconsin.
Yes, indeed. And I am a product of your fine University of Wisconsin, Madison.
See, I knew I felt some kind of a kinship when I was reading your stuff. In the trivia department, you were on Jeopardy a few years ago.
Yes, for exactly one episode, and I lost. I did make a true daily double and lost a lot, but at least I kind of went out fighting.
So it's small trivia.
Yeah.
Okay. You write whenever possible, it looks like, but you're also a sought-after consultant and lecturer of things analytical, artistic, architectural, and a few other areas. And to our audience, for a whole produce section of things that Tom Vanderbilt writes about, I suggest you go to tomvanderbilt.com, click on writing, and you'll be amazed. So, did a lot of reading. Who and what are you? I can't put my finger on it.
You know, I'm just a curious person, I guess, with no discernible skill set except a you know, slight ability to put thoughts into words. So that's what where I've ended up. I have been working on this new book that's coming out in January, if I could just plug that, called Beginners. And I've been working on that for a few years, and it basically is about trying to learn a bunch of new skills, because I realized that I hadn't learned any new skills in a long time. And the reason I realized this is because I have a child, a daughter, and back when she was, you know, about 4 years old, she wanted to learn how to play chess, and I thought that was a fine idea, except I didn't really know myself how to play. So that just sent me into a whole tailspin of anxiety that I was, you know, sort of resting on my laurels, such as they were, and, you know, kind of in this midlife cocoon of competence, and wanted to just, you know, sort of reach out, stretch out a bit and try some new things the way that she and, like, all kids actually are doing all the time. And that led to trying to learn to sing, kind of related to what we're talking about here. But that's, you know, that's how I got to that point.
Okay, and we'll get to the singing in a moment. The the subhead to your beginner's book is The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. I don't know if it's the finished product or not, but I saw a rendering of the cover, and there's a little surfer on it.
There is, and that was one of these skills that had long been of interest and sort of fascination to me, but never having actually done it. You know, growing up in the Midwest, it's not the most surf-friendly area. But, you know, it was always out there, and then time passed, never got around to it, and then decided, approaching age 50, that, you know, why not? And which, it turns out, you know, there are other people like me out there. But it's been an amazing experience, that and all sorts of other things. And the quick takeaway is that you're basically never too old, and you don't have to become amazing at something. You don't have to put in 10,000 hours and become an expert. You can put in 10 hours, and it can sort of change your life.
Yeah. By the way, there is a book called Some Like It Cold, and it's about the guys who surf Lake Michigan off of Sheboygan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you can surf in Wisconsin. Don't.
Yes, I never got around to that, though, even so.
Don't sell us short. I mean, that is hardcore surfing right there. Now, I don't mean to imply that you just sit down and write because it's fun. We can, I think, believe what it is you write. You must be either the person our president maintains he is, a stable genius, or you're a master of research. Which one is it?
Let's say the second one, because okay. I just, you know, I would say this goes back to University of Wisconsin-Madison. I was a history undergraduate, and it was inculcated in me the necessity to, you know, sort of always go deeper to look for the best documents, the primary documents. I spent a lot of time in the State Historical Society library there in Madison, buried in the stacks, and that persists to me this day, where I just love to delve into the more arcane the scientific journal, the better, in my opinion. And,
cool.
and there's some great, you know, titles out there. But anyway, so that's of what drives me.
The way I have it written in my notes is you put the free in freelancer. Your variety of interests seems so wide-ranging. How do you decide what to write next? Do you have things on a wall and you throw darts at it, or what happens?
No, it's basically whoever is willing to pay me for something. I mean, because I do have a mortgage. You know, yeah, being a freelancer, I think V.S. Naipaul, the writer, once said, to be a freelancer is great, but you have to earn your freedom. So it doesn't just come to you. You have to pay a lot to not go to the office. But I do have sort of a short attention span, and I'm a bit of a magpie. So whatever sort of percolating, I mean, thinking of something like singing or surfing, these were things I've had in mind for a long time. And with singing, you know, had done on my own, just like the way we all do in a shower or bar, but had never quite gone beyond that. Anyway, yeah, it's a strange business being a freelance writer. You never know where your next check is coming from, and you never know what your next idea is going to be.
Got to be exciting, though. And and if I may make an analogy, some of us remember the little kid Mikey who was the guinea pig in the old Life cereal commercials. And I found out that you're kind of the same age as the guy who played Mikey in those commercials. A couple of other kids were always reluctant to taste. And they said, hey, let's have Mikey. I envision publications coming up with a topic in a meeting and say, hey, let's get Tommy to try this.
It's a great image. I'm not sure if that's how it works or not. And by the way, there's an urban legend, I think, that actor had died. I think one of these strange urban legends, and I think I read that it was not true, that he's still alive and well.
I saw a current picture of him.
Okay.
Pretty cool, yeah. So you write articles for various publications, from Outside Magazine to The New Yorker, Wired, Car and Driver, The Financial Times. You write about swimming, hiking, evolution, and emojis, chess, cycling, sound in nature, and that's just a small tip of a big iceberg. Tom Vanderbilt on the phone with us. He's a journalist, a blogger, and an author, best-selling, by the way. I will, if I haven't already, preview some of the books that he's written. The bestseller was Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do, and What It Says About Us. Interesting as heck. Now, after all that setup that we've done here, Tom, laying a foundation of data-driven journalism, along comes an article for Time Magazine about the joy of singing, or the negative of that, no joy without singing. We've, here on my show, talked about group crooning several times and the benefits of it, including the memory choir phenomenon, which somehow proves the power of song on a whole nother level. You like to sing when you can, shoulder to shoulder, and when you can't, on apps and via other cyber song channels. What have you discovered about singing relative to what it adds to Tom Vanderbilt's life?
Well, you know, like a lot of people, I had done it when I was young, school and, you know, church settings, things like that. And one thing is that happens with us is that we eventually reach a stage where perhaps we're told we're not particularly good at it. We let it go for some reason, and then it just sort of disappears from our lives. And then, and this happened to me, and I, you know, then it just became a process of, I should preface this by saying I have no real musical training whatsoever, so that's an obstacle right there. But so, like a lot of people, I just couldn't help singing along to the radio and all that, never really in front of anyone, wasn't really a big karaoke person at all, but just did it in private, as sort of a private pleasure, and didn't really know if I was good or not, because it didn't really matter. I assumed I wasn't very good, but you don't let that get in the way. So working on this book, I decided, okay, I'm going to actually take some singing lessons. And, you know, of course, you go on the internet, there's a huge army of people out there, you know, willing to provide these vocal lessons, vocal coaches, and I found someone nearby, and so I did that for a while, because, you know, I thought that was the best way to try to get better, where I could feel confident enough to then maybe do it in some other way. I just didn't have enough confidence to burst out by myself. I really enjoyed it. I mean, it sort of was surprising to me as a skill how much of sort of a motor skill it is, you know, how much of muscle memory and training and practice comes into play. We're used to thinking of people as sort of God-given talents when it comes to voice, but it really is something that can be learned and trained like any other sport, let's say. And then secondly, it just made me feel really good, and there's this virtuous loop that happens. The better I felt about it, the more I wanted to practice, and the more I practiced, the sort of better I got. And when I say better, you know, there are apps on your phone that will, you know, measure your pitch and things and give you a kind of a feedback. So just in raw, you know, being in tune, I was sort of getting better that way. I'm not claiming that I've going to give, you know, Pavarotti or anyone else a run for their money, but I was just getting, you know, a little bit better, and you could see this progress over time, and that was very heartening as well. Yeah, it sort of felt like I had unlocked something that had been dormant for, you know, decades. Yeah, and then just to finish the story, I was doing the lessons for all, and that was great, but it felt very, you know, kind of closed. I was just in a room with a voice teacher. I wondered, was there some way to push beyond this? Went online, trying to look for a choir, found one that had a very generous set of entry requirements, which were very few, you know, no audition required. Joined that, and it basically became the favorite new thing in my life. I was just addicted. I was hooked from almost the first day. Community choirs, trying to introduce people to the joy of singing without necessarily having such a rigorous set of prerequisites to join. And it's once a week, typical rehearsal schedule, more as the show approaches. And then there's a performance every semester, I call it, which also was quite fun because, again, you know, I hadn't been on stage singing since I think I was in the third grade, and it was a little assembly or something like that. So it's just all sorts of fun and really brought an energy and new sorts of people into my life and new challenges. And it was, I was terrified in the beginning, so I just tried to pick up by aping people around me, and I'm sure I was lip-syncing half the time, but I was actually singing at some point rather than just mouthing the words. And yeah, it was such a positive addition.
But not being able to get together with the choir, you found a different way. Tell us about that. A wonderful new virtual choir of people you'd never met and probably will never meet.
It's called Smule, and that's a weird mashup of the words sonic and mule. You'll have to ask the CEO about that. But it was started a few years ago. He was trying to sort of, through technology, bring singing and music to more people. And you sign up, you sort of either upload a song yourself or look for someone else's performance, and then you could join them in a duo. So let's say it's Take It Easy by the Eagles. They've already done half of it. You sort of join in, and it's recorded. You could also do it live, but that's sort of strange. But anyway, so it's just a way to have people across the world in all kinds of different situations. I've had sung with people from Indonesia, from Mexico, from down the block probably, singing all kinds of styles, different languages. You know, online culture can be a bit iffy, but I found it to be also a particularly positive experience. I don't know their exact user statistics, but let's say millions of people worldwide, and over 100 people met on the site, basically got married, had children. They call them Smule babies.
Wow.
Because, you know, singing is such an intimate way to communicate, and to sing with someone, I think, you know, can in some ways unlock things that merely talking cannot. So perhaps it's particularly charged way to kind of communicate with someone that unlocks some other level of relationship. Not always, but...
Is it only audio, or is there a visual aspect to it?
You can do either audio or video, and
okay.
Some people really play up the video part in terms of the performative aspect, even kind of dressing up a little bit or having interesting lighting. Other more introverted people, such as myself, might more frequently go to with just the audio. Then at least you don't have to think about how you look as you're singing, which is sort of adds a whole other layer. But again, it's something that you can get better at, too, and that's a funny thing about singing. There's a guy, Ingo Tietze, from the National Voice Institute. As he put it to me, you know, 80% of singing is how you sell the song, not actually your technical ability, but as sort of a show person. You know, and that's what you see when you do live karaoke. It's really about kind of an exaggerated showmanship. But there's all sorts of people and all sorts of different styles on Smule, and some people are very serious. Other people are just there to have a good time. Yeah, it's a great substitute for not being able to sing with people in person.
Does this whole singing phenomenon, you know, and your love for it and missing it, does that surprise you about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways you think maybe when you get to age 50 or something, you have most of life figured out what you're going to be doing for the next 20, 30 years or whatever. But this came out of the blue. And when I told some friends or family members that I was joining this choir, they sort of, you know, did a double take. And they're like, you? It's gotten to the point where, you know, just on a personal note, we've been going through some potential move in terms of our house. And one of the conditions is that I have to make sure I'm still close enough to the choir location. So when we do start up again in the future, I can still attend.
Oh, there you go.
So I can't move, you know, back to Wisconsin. It's just out of the question.
Okay. Not that
there aren't great choirs there, I'm sure.
Oh, there are. You pointed out in the article that by participation figures, choral singing is America's most popular performing art. We've talked about that here on this show. Does singing feel like it's going to be part of your life from now on?
Definitely. And this is one of the many things I tried in the book that really stuck the most. You know, surfing, you have to acquire equipment, you have to wait for the right conditions, you have to travel to the ocean. Singing you can do, you know, in your car, in your bedroom, it's very easy to practice. It just always makes you feel better, almost without fail. And it's really an essential human, you know, desire, something that we want to do. There's an argument by an anthropologist that humans were actually communicating in sort of melodic sounds before we even had language. It does seem to function on some whole other level than simply communicating.
It's easy to figure out why you're a fascinating guy, because you're fascinated with the world around you and beyond. So, hey, way to go, Tom Vanderbilt. I suggest to our listening audience, look for his books In Places Where the Good Stuff Is Found. When again is Beginners coming out?
January 2021.
Tom Vanderbilt, Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks you, and come back and visit now and then.
Okay, thanks a lot, Al.
You can get everything you need at tomvanderbilt.com. That's where all his books are. And the article I was alluding to was in the current July Time magazine issue. The article's called No Joy Without Singing. Well, keep in mind you can access any and all Spectrum West episodes online at WPR.org. Click Shows, Spectrum West, and the date you'd like to hear or download. If you're ever not around that cool old device called a radio, long about 10 a.m. on a Thursday, and you want to catch the show live online, you can always pull up WRFW887.com and hit Listen Live. There's a link there. Next week, nothing from me. It's politics just before the Wisconsin primaries. We'll return with a fresh Spectrum West on August 13th. Thanks to Catherine Thomas, Jim Oliver, Dean Kallenbach, Kate Spranger. Live smart, be safe, and let's get together again in a couple weeks, okay? Okay.